From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, John Heilman of Bloomberg Politics discusses what the first order of business will be for the Trump administration, and actor Michael T. Williamson reflects on his career and his role in the critically acclaimed film Fences. But first, New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker made news when he spoke out against the nomination of Jeff Sessions of Alabama as Attorney General. In doing so, he became the first sitting senator to testify against a colleague's nomination for a cabinet post. Senator Booker said that he voiced his opposition because, quote, law and order without justice is unattainable, end quote. He joins us now to talk about his actions and about the Democratic Party's strategy under the Trump administration. Senator, good to have you back on this program, sir.
It's great to be back on the program. Thank you very much for having me. And Tavis, I really just appreciate your constant voice, especially during times like this.
So much commentary all around the country about your opposition to Jeff Sessions. No sitting senator has ever gone against another sitting senator in a hearing the way you did. Tell me more about why you chose that tact.
Well, I mean, the criminal justice system in our country, as so many communities around our nation know, is savagely broken, and its jagged edges are destroying the lives of many, many people. 5% of the globe's population, one out of every four imprisoned people on the planet Earth are here in America. Overwhelmingly, we're incarcerating the most vulnerable of our citizens, the mentally ill, the drug addicted, poor folks. As Brian Stevenson said, you get in America, you're treated better if you're rich and guilty than poor and innocent. And then, of course, disproportionately people of color. It's been this drug war during my lifetime that has so exploded our prison population, 800% on the federal level, and has disproportionately impacted African-Americans, Latinos, people of color, because we know there's no difference between blacks and whites in dealing drugs or using drugs, but African-Americans will be arrested for that almost four times more likely. And so here you have this system that is chewing up so many people, disproportionately infecting communities, and frankly, people who come out of this system for doing things the last two presidents said they had done, now can't find jobs, can't get a Pell Grant for college, can't get food stamps and the like. And so this is something I've been working on with Senate Republicans. Even the chairman of the Judiciary Committee has partnered with us on this. But someone who has been the outlier fighting against us has been Jeff Sessions. And so on this issue and so many more, LGBT rights, the rights of inequality of women, police accountability, he has, from his position and in the years before, fought against the efforts that we've been making, fought against what the Justice Department has been doing. And now to see him going to ascend to the highest law enforcement office in the land in charge of the Justice Department, he has told us that he won't fight and defend and uplift the rights and values of all Americans. And so I could not sit idly by without doing everything I could to speak out against what I believe is going to roll back the clock for many Americans and leave many Americans who right now are being defended by this Justice Department with not the federal government working to defend them.
What I do know, Senator Booker, is the way you have been treated or maltreated, depending on one's perspective on what you did in social media or more broadly in the mainstream media space. What I don't know, and I'm curious to know, is how you've been treated inside the Senate. Relatively speaking, you are a newbie to this body, relatively speaking. And I don't know how senators who've been there longer than you take to a young guy like yourself coming in and just abridging all the rules of decorum, as it were, in the U.S. Senate. So how have you been treated or not treated, as it were, by your colleagues since you spoke out in those hearings days ago?
Well, I appreciate you asking the question. I've developed really good friendships in the 3 years I've been here on both sides of the aisle. I know I definitely stepped on Senate norms and stepped on the toes of many people who believe that they are really important. But, you know, when you're sitting next to John Lewis and giving those remarks, I don't think he asked when he did a lot of the things that resulted in him getting beaten and severely injured. I don't think he stopped and asked, is this breaking norms or is this politic or is this safe? He did it anyway. And anything that I've done pales in comparison, is not even a shadow of the greatness of which I sat next to and which you and I both as children born in the post-civil rights era have inherited. So, so you know, be what may, this is where I stand, this is what I did, I'll accept the consequences, and if it chills relationships in the Senate, I understand that, I respect my colleagues, but this is one of those moments in American history. With all that's going on in police-community relations, with all that's going on with the continued violence against LGBT Americans, against women, when Senator Sessions has spoken out against the Violence Against Women's Act, spoken out against the Matthew Shepard Act, spoken out against the Justice Department's effort to hold police departments accountable. With all that's on the line, with the most powerful law enforcement person in line, I had to speak out no matter what the consequences.
Before I move forward, Senator, I'd be remiss not to ask you, since you raised his name a moment ago, John Lewis, I'd be remiss not to ask you what you have made over the last few days of the attack that Mr. Lewis came under from the president.
Well, it's stunning to me that not only his attack on him, if it was maybe narrowly tailored to John Lewis's remarks and in a respectful manner, I still wouldn't have agreed with it or thought it was justified. But he made a bold statement about John Lewis being a man of all talk and not action. And that is outrageous for me, to hear that from someone and to question John Lewis for challenging Donald Trump's legitimacy. In many ways, that is painful to me to hear him strike back like that, especially after he himself did just that, question the legitimacy of Barack Obama time and time again in a way that was candidly crass to me and craven. And so I just think this is yet another data point for people as they look at the presidency, forget who's in it, as a position where you show dignity, where you show restraint, where you are magnanimous, that Donald Trump does not have that in him. And in many ways, I think, looking at the way he's been tweeting and attacking so many people, unfortunately, I fear that after the dignity of the White House being elevated yet again by President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, that I think that it's going to be a different kind of White House in the days ahead. And it's very disappointing to me, whether you're Republican or Democrat. I think most Americans want their president to evidence the best of our values, not kind of a Twitter troll-like teenage petulance. And actually, I'm being disrespectful to teenagers, because you see much better you see much better behavior from young and old than you're often seeing evidenced by him.
I was laughing at your comment, and I was just about to say, don't laugh at my question. So I'll see if you return the favor or not. The question I want to ask now, which again might seem funny given what you've just said, you used a term in this conversation earlier, Senator Booker, outlier. Clearly, Donald Trump has been the quintessential ultimate outsider, outlier, I should say, to get to where he is now as the president of these United States. I wonder, though, in all seriousness, whether or not you think that Donald Trump will moderate, can become a decent president. I don't need to tell you, you're a student of history, that Abraham Lincoln, who was no Donald Trump, let me be clear about that, but Abraham Lincoln started out on the wrong side of the slavery question, and eventually he made the right turn. Bobby Kennedy had to grow. He wasn't in the White House as president, but history shows us full well that Bobby Kennedy had to grow. And there are other great Americans and great leaders around the world who had to grow. Is it possible, you think, that over the next 4 years, Donald Trump would not be as laughable as he is to some?
Well, look, I'm not one of those people that says that I want Donald Trump to fail in terms of if he's trying to do right by our country, create economic opportunity for all, reduce levels of violence. If he takes on strategies, I want him to do the right thing. But I don't have expectation of that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I may be a prisoner of hope, as you and I both are on so many issues. But I have no expectation. If someone tells you, as Maya Angelou says, who they are, believe them the first time. And he didn't moderate in his campaign. He didn't moderate when he won the Republican nomination. He didn't moderate when he became president-elect. I do not expect him to evolve when he's president. And nor do I advise people to. Because to stop him from doing what it looks like he intends to do is going to take us organizing. It's going to take engagement and activity. And people should be preparing to fight, to defend, to resist, to seize ground where we can and hold it where we've gained it and earned it in the past. And so I really do see my role as someone who is going to continue to look across the aisle in the Senate. I've partnered with a lot of senators on legislation that I'm really proud of. But as I look towards the presidency and know what he it seems like he intends to do with the Environmental Protection Agency, with the Justice Department, with foreign policy and relationship with the Russians. All of these things make me ready to roll up my sleeves and go to work in fighting and defending and advancing the causes that I think he's threatening.
We'll talk about how the Democrats, how progressives fight back in just a second. But since you mentioned some legislation that you're working on, let me go to a couple of pieces of that and get your get you to expound on what you're attempting to do. I want to raise first the issue of this Muslim ban. We heard, to your point, all throughout the campaign, this bluster and bravado coming out of Mr. Trump about what he was going to do when he elected and when he got into office about Muslims in this country. You, of course, have your name on some legislation to push back on that. Tell me about the legislation.
Well, there's a program that was initiated during the Bush administration that Obama, to his credit, stopped using, but the mechanism remained. It's called NSEERS, a National Security Entry Exit Registration System. And so he's actually got, as a leftover from the immediate post 9/11 period, this ability to force people to register based upon their country of origin. Now, interestingly, when Bush did it, there were 25 countries, 24 of them were Muslim nations, majority Muslim nations. One of them was North Korea. And so I put in legislation just disbanding the ability from the United States to create registries based on race, national origin, religion, and a few other factors. This belies who we are as a nation and our history, and I think the fundamental values are enshrined in the Constitution. And so we put forth legislation to deny him the apparatus with which to create a Muslim registry. And obviously we're going to have a difficult time getting such legislation passed, but I hope to force people to have to vote on it and be on the record for what kind of values do they support within our government. And now if he tries to do any kind of Muslim registry or tries to reengage the NSEERS program, we have to again rally together as a nation and resoundingly reject that. Because I don't care if you are a Christian American, if you're an atheist American, anytime you see a president or some leader calling for people to have to register based on a category like religion, please understand that that is a serious threat to everything we say we are, we believe we are, and we tell the globe who we are and what we stand for.
The other piece of legislation that I want to get to briefly here is criminal justice reform. It had been thought, and it's been written about, as you know, in a myriad of number of places, that there is one issue that Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate might get some traction on, and it is the issue of criminal justice reform. You know, my sense is that Democrats are behind that for one reason, Republicans behind it for another reason, namely saving money, but I'll let you expound upon that. But where are we now that Mr. Trump is, in fact, the new president on this issue of criminal justice reform? Is something meaningful going to come out of Congress on that issue?
Well, so we've had the Obama administration be extraordinary leaders in this issue. Everything from the Justice Department under President Obama giving instructions to U.S. attorneys around this country to pull back for nonviolent offenders these large mandatory minimums, which has resulted in a lowering of sentencing around this country on a federal level. Mm-hmm. We've seen him not only visit prisons, but come out and start to commute sentences at a level and a rate that we've never seen in American history. There's a lot of things that President Obama's been doing that really have been about overall criminal justice reform, from police accountability all the way to sentencing. Now you have Donald Trump, who not only has spoken out about this, emphasizing terms that have such painful historic accords, like that law and order drum that he was beating, and to so many who understand our history, understand that law and order cries were used by Nixon and others as a way of going after, frankly, elements or organized activists on the left, people of color and others. And so I worry that a man that's been beating that drum of law and order, not talking about the higher principle and the higher calling of this country, which is justice, is not going to look kindly on criminal justice reform. And if one of his first nominees is Jeff Sessions, a person who has spoken out against criminal justice reform, spoken out against sentencing reduction, spoken out against police accountability, spoken out against even voting rights and other things, it does not give me hope that Donald Trump is going to be someone who becomes a champion of these issues. And so all of us who know that we live in this distraught present, where we have a criminal justice system that is a major violation of American values, wasting trillions of dollars on building prisons, with more people in the South living in prisons than on college campuses, the waste of our public treasury, a waste of human life, with practices within our prisons, like juvenile solitary confinement that other countries consider torture because of the negative consequences for children that are put in such environments, emotional harm and traumatizing realities. I don't have much faith that Donald Trump is going to become a champion for moving us as a country away from this distraught present. And two, what some states are starting to see, even red states, are starting to see that when they bring in humane policies to criminal justice system and lower their prison populations, they actually lower crime as well. But I'm not giving up. I spent 3 years working on everything from ban the box legislation, helping people coming out of prison have a fair shot at jobs, all the way to working on, with Chairman Grassley, Republican Chairman Grassley, the Judiciary Committee, real legislation. I'm not giving up the fight, and I'm going to continue to work to raise the consciousness of our country, because, as you said, you find people on both sides of the aisle, from the Heritage Foundation, Koch brothers, Newt Gingrich, whatever their motivations are, the reality is they're speaking directly to this issue as something that we need to do something about. And so you have Christian evangelical leaders coming from the Christian context on the right saying we need to change this, to even libertarians who think this is a massive overreach of federal government, to even just fiscal hawks, as you said, who say, why are we spending these hundreds of billions of dollars on a failed system? It's so failed that when we release people, because we don't empower them to succeed, the majority of people in many cases are coming back into the prison system. So I'm going to continue this fight. I know a lot of people are with me. This is one of America's great shames. And I believe, I actually have faith in America that we're going to change this. And you're starting to see that in red states and blue states around America. But the federal system must change as well.
So that even if Democrats can come up with a unified strategy to fight back against the agenda that Mr. Trump wants to put forth, and I've yet to see that. We'll talk about the Democratic Party in just a second here. But even if they can come up, Senator Booker, with a unified strategy, how do you fight back against so many rollbacks in so many areas simultaneously?
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we've now lost a whole collection of leadership. I mean, you have Loretta Lynch, you have Barack Obama. I mean, you have people that were fighting these battles on all fronts, often against states like Oklahoma, where you had the EPA nominee, Mr. Pruitt, fighting against the EPA for trying to do things to protect clean water and clean air. We lose all of that. And really, the front lines of this fight now are Democrats in the Senate, but also us, we the people. And people don't often underestimate their power. You know the saying by Alice Walker, who said the most common way people give up their power is not realizing they have it in the first place. Mm-hmm. If we stop expressing our outrage, if we allow these kind of assaults on human dignity, human opportunity to normalize, then we give up, we surrender our power, and we surrender even the moral high ground, becoming complicit in what's happening. We saw one of the very first actions of the new Republican Congress in the House was to try to take away the teeth of independent ethics oversight. And there was such an outcry that moved through the right as well that they eventually had to reverse their position. So this is something where we have to realize, even if the odds seem impossible, as they did in the civil rights movement, and they did in the workers' rights movement, as they did in the women's rights movement, we have to still stand up and fight and resist, because silence is the enemy. Apathy is the enemy. It's not just, as King said, the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, but the appalling silence and inaction of the good people. So on the front lines in Washington, I'm going to work on every front that I can, and a lot of 48 Senate Democrats, House members like John Lewis, you're seeing them find ways to resist. But the public at large, this cannot be a Washington fight. It has to be the public at large saying, you know what, as an American citizen, I'm going to do more in 2017 to be aware of the issues, to engage in the issues, to follow leaders on social media so that they can tell me what's happening. And when they put out a cry for organizing or for responding, we're there to do something, to do some small act in the cause of my country.
Speaking of Americans and the role they play, there are a lot of Americans who are aligned with your party, the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party does not have its new leader yet. I'm not asking you who, if you're behind anybody, and if you are, you can tell me that. But I guess the question is, what does the Democratic Party do now? I saw the Chicago Cubs in the White House the other day, and I saw the president make what I thought was a pretty funny joke. He turned to Theo Epstein, who, as you know, used to run the Boston Red Sox and then went to Chicago Cubs, and made a joke about Epstein being the head of the DNC because he was good at bringing teams back from the dead. So I expect that Theo Epstein is not going to leave the Chicago Cubs to run the DNC. But what does this party have to do to get itself back on track?
Well, I want some new energy, some dynamic new energy, a strong progressive, somebody that can rally folks together and bring in, like we've seen now, the realities with social media. And I'm one of those people that's trying to say, hey, we need to pay attention because, you know, on my Facebook feed and my Twitter feed on this device, I can reach more people than, you know, an MSNBC show often can in an early morning appearance. So we've got to start letting people in to know the new tools of communication that are strong in their progressive stripes and not wavering, and folks that can bring some new dynamism and energy. I think it should be a full-time job, and I'm happy to see even the elected leaders that are running for this are talking about that they would give up their position. So I see a lot of strong candidates, and I'm just hopeful that this leader understands that in a time where you don't have a Democratic president, the leader of the DNC has got to be out there working hard every single day, rallying the troops at the base grassroots level. That this is going to be a grassroots effort if we're going to see America succeed in the long term. We got to build the Democratic Party, rebuild, re-energize, re-fortify from the grassroots up.
And beyond just those who are affiliated with the Democratic Party, how do citizens who are troubled by this presidency organize themselves?
We've got to find a way to get people to understand that they have power, that the power of the people is greater than the people in power. And if they're not getting the results they want out of the politics of this country, they have to shape and mold those politics then in a different way. And so I look forward to having a different types of conversations as I'm out on the road. I'm not waiting to the 2018 midterm elections. I'm going to be traveling throughout the country as well as my state, obviously, where my base is and the people I'm sworn an oath to fight for and protect and empower. But I want to let the message be known that we've got to become more inclusive. We've got to give people a reason to be excited, a reason to be engaged, a reason to believe again that this country is not controlled by elites, by corporations, but that it's controlled by the people. And again, if people exercising their power, engaging, standing up and fighting, they always win. History shows that under worse circumstances than now, leaders that were heralding worse demagoguery than we see now. People have overcome that before through that grassroots engagement, through standing up for our collective values, and through making sure it's sacrificed. That's what patriotism is. Mm. It's love of country. Love is not a being verb. It's an action verb. And we who have inherited from the actions and struggles of those in the past have to give our good measure of that same kind of commitment. If not, I fear what's going to happen to our country in the future if the people who have most at stake are not getting engaged more than they were in 2016 or before.
Let me close, since we've been friends for so long, with a personal question. So there are all kinds of stories written. I mean, you were so brilliant in your testimony at the hearing for Jeff Sessions. All kinds of commentary written about the fact that Cory Booker has already sounded off for the 2020 contest. So your name is already being bandied about for those on the shortlist to fight back against Mr. Trump, assuming he runs for re-election in 2020. How are you going to stay focused when that chorus starts to rise about Booker, Booker, Booker in 2020?
Well, I think I do a disservice to myself and anybody if they're starting to focus on 2020 now. I think life is about purpose and not position. Live your purpose now. Be authentic in this moment. Fight the good fight. That's what we should expect from each other. Whoever's going to be in 2020, I want them to earn the loyalty and the love of the people. And there's a lot of good folks out there, from governors that I know to congresspeople to senators, that have this tremendous leadership opportunity. And I hope that my prayer is that we have a lot of great choices for the highest office in the land. For me, I want to be a great senator and show the New Jersey that I deserve to be reelected in 2020 and that I've stayed true to the fight. And even if we lose some battles down here, that I fought with honor, with a tenaciousness, and with an integrity that we really need in this country now more than ever.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. John Heilman is the co-managing editor of Bloomberg Politics. He's also the co-author of best-selling books, including Game Change, and can be seen in the new Sundance and Showtime documentary, Trumped, Inside the Greatest Political Upset of All Time. He talks about what the first 100 days of the Trump administration will look like and much more.
John Heilman, good to have you back on the program.
Good to be here, brother. Nice to see
you. You all right, man?
I'm good. I'm all right, as good as can be expected.
Yeah. Unpack that for me, as can be expected.
Well, we are headed into a period of great uncertainty and potential danger. And so I think, you know, I say that not in a partisan way.
Sure,
I just mean there's a sense of we don't know what's about to happen.
Right.
And we know on the basis just of the campaign we just witnessed and the president's behavior while president-elect that we are going to see stuff we've never seen before.
Uncertainty I take, and I'm not disagreeing with you on danger, but since I'm a host, I gotta just challenge you on that.
Yeah.
Uncertainty I get, why danger though?
Well, I think, look, the reality is that we have a very sturdy constitutional republic that has served us well for 240 years. There are a lot of institutional guardrails around any president, Democrat, Republican, whoever, like him or hate him. There are a few places where presidents exercise pretty much unchecked authority, including the ability in many cases to wage war, and some things to do with intelligence. And I think that one of the things that people, all people of goodwill, must have some questions about is Trump's temperament. You know, we've seen the man in states of sleeplessness, in the middle of the night, getting in fights with people who have annoyed him, some of whom are much less powerful than him. Acting in a way that seems like not fully controlled or fully disciplined. And when you take the intersection of a temperament that is that demonstrates those some of those potential areas of concern with areas where presidents can do whatever they want, again, that's a little can be a little dangerous. It may prove to be that President Trump restrains himself and finds a kind of balance and discipline that sometimes have been lacking in the past and that we have nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
I hope so.
So I don't buy this argument that he restrains himself. What I am somewhat hopeful about is that the people around him who are wiser, have experienced the game at a high level for years, not all of them, but certainly some of them, that they may be able to pull his coattail. So what about that notion?
Well, it's a very, obviously many people who are looking for comfort in this era think that there's a chance that that will be the case.
Yeah.
The issue is that he has appointed some people to his cabinet, and there are some people around him that he's putting in his White House who have a lot of experience, are people that have been around the game for a long time. There's also no question that the White House staff at the senior levels will be more inexperienced than any White House staff in our lifetime. So will those people exercise, impose some discipline on him? Maybe, possibly, hopefully. Will the normal restraints the politics impose? He wants to be popular. He wants to be loved. He wants to be a great president. I have no doubt that Donald Trump in his mind wants all those things.
I agree. Yeah.
And so those things may bring him to some place of sobriety that's different than it was during the campaign. But I'll just say that he was surrounded by by his family, who other people look to be as a restraint on him. He's surrounded by those people during the campaign. And the truth was, one of the things that we've learned so far about Trump is that Trump does what he wants, mostly. You know, he ultimately is his own main counsel. And so to what extent he will be held back or guided by anyone who he's put around him, again, is one of the many things we do not know the answer to as of now.
So I'm not naive about the fact that Trump controls the White House, Republicans control the House, Republicans control the Senate, and ever more so, very soon, the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So I get all that. And yet, I wonder whether or not the Republicans on the Hill are going to be where they're going to help him pump his brakes, so to speak, on certain things.
Right. I think your question is the right question because, frankly, Democrats are going to oppose Trump on almost everything, and they don't have that much power to stop him. Republicans.
John McCain, Lindsey Graham,
and others, right? And others, you know, libertarians who don't like that he spends too much or he wants to spend too much. There are a lot of different factions in the Republican Party, many of whom disagree with Trump on various things. So when it comes to the intelligence community, he's at war with them right now. The Russia question is still a huge question, his relationship with Russia, where he has people in the Republican Party who are concerned about all of that. There are areas in foreign policy, there are areas in domestic policy, there are areas in terms of spending and fiscal policy where Trump's views and the policies that he says he believes in are not the conventional views of the post-war Republican Party. So there are a variety of areas where it seems to me either institutionally Republicans may be a restraint to him, or where they're ideologically are going to be in a different place than him. Do a lot of Republicans want to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure? Now, there are Democrats who think that would be a great idea. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of Republicans who didn't have an appetite for Barack Obama's $800 billion stimulus when we were coming out of the Great Recession. Are they going to want to spend $1 trillion now on infrastructure just because Donald Trump and Steve Bannon want to spend that money? Mm-hmm. There is going to be fascinating to watch Trump, who is, I think, not ideological, broadly speaking. Mm-hmm. He is transactional. Yeah. He is opportunistic. It's going to be interesting to watch him try to navigate mostly his own party, over which he has staged what can only be described as a hostile takeover. He's not a Republican,
yeah, sure,
in most important ways. So that area where Republicans may serve as a curb on his ambitions in various areas is going to be, I think, where a lot of the action is over the next 100 days and maybe over the next 4 years.
Let me ask you a question, which I admit up front I find to be somewhat silly. But I'm asking only because, yeah, this silly question is being bandied about all around social media. And I was at a dinner party, and it was some very smart people. And this was like a very serious conversation.
I can't imagine you going to dinner with anybody but really smart people.
Yeah, well, that's not true.
Okay.
You don't know my friends.
Okay.
But, sorry, friends. But anyway, I don't know if it's just recklessly being hopeful,
yeah,
or naive, or whether or not there's something here, you tell me. The storyline about the fact that Trump, in a matter of time, is going to find himself engaged in some impeachable offenses. Right. There are people who are hopeful and believe, in fact, that because there's so much going on with this guy,
right,
that we don't know about, we never saw his taxes, his sons, we are told are running his business, we know he's not above using any platform he has to advance his business interests, right, et cetera, et cetera, that it's just a matter of time before he does something that is impeachable, to which I ask, who's going to impeach him? The Republicans in the House? So just talk, you've heard this storyline,
yes,
before. What do you make of this?
Well, I think that to begin with,
yeah,
one of the things that's true is that because Trump has not addressed in any adequate way, and I say this again, a nonpartisan way, you've got Republican and Democratic ethics specialists,
right,
from the Bush White House, the George W. Bush White House, the Obama White House, all saying that he has not addressed in any meaningful, substantive, or let alone comprehensive way, the conflicts of interest that his business and his holdings create for him as President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, the question of whether he has violated the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which says that a president can't enrich himself in any way from the office, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he is going to be, I believe, subject to litigation from the moment he takes the oath of office.
Mm-hmm.
So potential scandal, litigation, challenges to the constitutionality of his presidency will be starting on day one. And that could be a huge problem for him. And again, you want to go back to where Republicans have concerns about Trump.
Right.
They have concerns with him about Russia, they have, yeah, concerns with him about the intelligence community, and they have concerns on this front. They're worried about it on Capitol Hill. Republicans, as much as Democrats, would like Trump to have done something, right, more significant about these ethics questions. So will he do things that could be violent of the Constitution? Many people think that he will be.
Yeah.
Will there be challenges in courts over that? Yes, there will. Is there potential for scandal? Yes, there is. I think all of those things are perfectly reasonable things to be focused on, whether you are an opponent of Trump or or just an observer of the Democratic political,
mm-hmm,
scene. Your question, though, is the correct question. And we're in a very different world than the last time a president was impeached or tried to be impeached. Very different from the late 1990s when it was Bill Clinton. Very,
mm-hmm,
different from Richard Nixon. Really different from the early 1970s.
Yeah.
And the main way in which the world is different is that our politics are so much more radically partisan and so much more polarized. And so in an environment where Republicans, who for a year and a half said they would never support Trump, they thought he was a grave constitutional threat, they thought he wasn't temperamentally suited to the office, they have piled in line behind, mm-hmm, Trump after he won. They did it because in the end they've got the red jersey on and they're going to be Republicans. And that gets to the question of, will Trump commit impeachable offenses? He may. Will Trump get impeached? I think the likelihood is extraordinarily small. I mean, I have a big imagination, so I can imagine him doing things that would be so bad that they could lead to his impeachment. But in the normal spectrum,
yeah,
of things that would be considered impeachable or scandal-worthy offenses,
okay,
I think Republicans, by and large, will rally around him, and you would need to have, I mean, if you had a Democratic House and Senate,
yeah,
it would be a really different world. But,
yeah,
in this world, I think that for a long time, Republicans will wear that jersey and try to ride it out with Trump, no matter what he does.
So when I made the Heilman argument,
yeah,
at this dinner party the other night. This was the pushback. Tavis, what you're not looking at is that Republicans don't like Trump. Mr. Howman is right. They've lined up behind him because it's in their best interest at the moment. But what if this guy does something that is impeachable and they can get rid of him and Pence moves up, who they actually like? Pence is a true Republican, died-in-the-wool Republican. So to that you say?
To that I say, all those things are true. But they had many opportunities to try to stop Trump in an effective way while he was running for president, while he got closer to the nomination, once he had the nomination. The Republican Party has the fact that he's not that popular among Republicans. There have been, though, it was a never Trump movement. They tried to stop Trump. You know what? They didn't stop him. It's possible that you could look up on a day. I mean, again, if you want to do crazy scenario planning, you look up on a day where Trump's popularity a year in is so bad. Again, I'm not predicting this. I'm saying if you want a scenario under which your friend's thesis could occur, it would be a day when Trump's popularity was so bad a year into office that he had an approval rating of 12% or 14%, and Republicans in the House and Senate were looking at a catastrophe in the midterm elections. And they thought the only way for us to save ourselves is to cut him loose. And that was true in the election, too. The reason that the Never Trump thing, the moments when it seemed like it had the greatest chance of stopping him, was at the moment was the moments when members of the House and Senate were most concerned about their own political futures. When they started to think that their polling was holding up and that they could maybe get reelected without having to get rid of Trump and all the messiness that that would entail, like at the Republican convention, they immediately were like, okay, well, we can live with Trump. You know, if he doesn't, you know, as long as he doesn't drag us down too much, you know, we don't want to get, because the problem is that Trump still is the most, whatever else you want to say about it, he won for a reason. He won because he had a overwhelming support of 40 to 45% of the Republican electorate, which is the biggest voting block there is. And a lot of those people are still scared of those voters, even if they don't like Trump. They're scared of those voters getting on the wrong side of Trump's voters.
He is the co-star of a new documentary called Trumped that's coming to Showtime. John, always good to have you here, man.
Tavis, you're great.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Michael T. Williamson is best known for his role as Bubba Blue in the movie Forrest Gump. The talented actor, whose many credits include the ABC series Designated Survivor, now stars opposite Denzel Washington and Viola Davis in the film adaptation of August Wilson's play Fences. Before we talk to Michael T., here's a clip from the film.
Hey, hey, there's Choice Boy.
How you doing, Uncle Gabe?
Lion! The king of the jungle. Rose, hey, Rose, I got a flower for you. I picked it myself. That's the same Rose like you is.
Oh, that's right. Nice of you, Gabe.
What you been doing, Uncle Gabe?
Oh, I've been chasing hellhounds and waiting for the time to tell St. Peter to open the gates.
I'm just me, and I don't have an Academy vote.
Okay.
But if I had one, as I've said to every friend I know, you'd get mine on, it just, it's over with. Man, you killed this role.
Thank you so
much. And I know you've played it on Broadway, but what you brought to this role in film was just amazing to me. How did you know, or what made you believe that you could take this character from the stage and make it work on film?
Confidence in August Wilson.
Yeah.
August Wilson is, in my opinion, the most prolific American playwright. Not to take anything away from Tennessee Williams or any of the others, or Shakespeare, even for that matter, on a global front. But to mention August Wilson's name in concert with Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams and on, it's a compliment to all those men.
It's
to, you know, to take nothing away. But the confidence in that material that it would translate. If you tell the truth with it, it worked on Broadway when we did it on Broadway, and it worked in cinema when we used the cinematic application of it. But it, the truth is the truth.
What did you learn? And I'm making the assumption here that you did. I could be wrong. If I am, I'll back up. What did you learn about August Wilson, about his writing, about his work? What did you learn about August Wilson that with all the performances you've done of this on stage, it took you doing it on film to see, to feel, to realize? Was there something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
On stage, I thought I understood the material completely, but in cinema, I realized I didn't. I did not understand how much those words meant, that journey of the two brothers. And on stage, I didn't realize that Gabriel was also Troy's caretaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, Troy wouldn't be who he is or have what he has without Gabriel's contribution. And that did not land on me as profoundly as it did on stage, as it did when we shot the film.
Yeah,
it's important. Intimacy gives you, it elevates creativity.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to yell, scream, use technique. I just whisper to you what I feel, and you feel it because it's intimate. And so that's what we learned, is that there's a much more powerful example of these words in cinema than on the boards or in theater.
Yeah.
I wished watching this film, I've been fortunate, given what I do, to have been invited over the years by a lot of friends like you and others, right, to come visit the set,
right,
when something is being shot. I wish that I'd been there a couple of days when y'all were filming this thing.
Right.
But for those of us who just get completely wrecked in the theater watching this emotionally, were there ever those kind of emotional outbursts or emotional moments in the filming of this?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell me something?
Sure.
Yeah.
I've been a fan of Denzel's for a very long time.
Right.
I've been a fan of Viola's for a very long time. Viola and I have worked together before. Denzel and I have not. But one of the things that I learned about Denzel is that the more you trust, the more that gives another person freedom. I didn't realize that until people asked Denzel, what did you do to direct and get these performances? He trusted us, completely trusted us. And I was embarrassed or ashamed not to bring my best work because Denzel completely trusted us. And that's one of the methods to his madness, yeah, to his magic, is to completely trust us. So I learned to trust on a much higher open level,
yeah,
because it elevated my work as well.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of actors over the years who have talked about their own process, their own methodology for how they inhabit a particular character.
Right.
I've talked to actors who, when they take on a character, take on the persona, they will stay in that character all day long. Even when they're not on set filming, they are Gabriel. They don't come out. Tell me about your process, how you inhabit a character like that. You go in, you go out, you stay there every day, you stay there for the entire film. What's Michael T's process?
Well, my process is all my characters are born from prayer. Mm-hmm. They're all the result of prayer, every single
character. Is it true that y'all start every day filming with prayer?
With prayer, absolutely.
Yeah.
Denzel has a prayer circle every single day.
Yeah.
And so that is part of his process. But for me, shame. People say, how do you go into character and stay in there? Because I can be cordial on a set and talk and laugh, but when it's time to go to work, when I go into character, I completely escape and forget where I am. I'm mm-hmm. in that character's world. And a lot of that comes from shame because of my own childhood, being molested as a kid, being ashamed of who I was, being abandoned by my father. Other kids had fathers. So I wanted to be anybody but who I was. And that has actually fed my gift as an actor, because I can disappear into a character completely and I'm gone. And my wife will go, honey, and I'm gone. I'm all the way there. And my kids, they get it. But if their friends are over, I won't rehearse. Mm-hmm. I won't practice or anything if other people are in the house, because I go, I'm gone.
What do you make of the fact, I hear you. I hear you, this intimacy is working, because yeah, I hear you and I feel you. And the moment you said that about the shame,
yes, sir,
I thought of Richard Pryor, who may very well be the freest black man that ever lived. Pryor was just that free. But if you know his backstory and the prostitution and the way he grew up in the house in Joliet, Illinois, Joliet, if you prefer.
Joliet,
yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. But you know Pryor's backstory, you understand a bit more how he came to be the artistic, the comedic genius that he was. So here you come now with this confession,
yeah,
that it is the shame that allows you to so brilliantly inhabit these particular characters. What do you make of that linkage, that it was, that the giftedness, the brilliance that we see come out of you artistically is born of a place of hurt and pain and shame? How do you link those things?
Well, I don't make a good victim. Yeah. So I'm no longer ashamed of my past.
Yeah.
But I realize how God used that. They said, your test will become your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what happened, is that the test, the things that I've been through in my life, I'm no longer ashamed of. Because I don't make a good victim. I don't have a victim mindset. I realize what happened, happened. And I'm okay. And I'm cool. I celebrate what I've been through because it has made me a very wealthy, conscious, kind, considerate human being.
Yeah. I don't know what, thank you for being so honest about that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I don't know how you process this, so let me just ask it. I don't know how you process it, so I don't know whether or not you have expectations of this industry or of this business. But when you are in a film that is as big as Forrest Gump.
Yes, sir.
And you're playing such a major character, and everybody loves that character, Bubba Blue.
Right.
And then they spin off restaurants.
Right. Called
Bubba Gump Shrimp House. And all. I mean, you know, right. It's a huge film. They had a lot of legs. And clearly, you've been a working actor for a long time.
Right.
But there are people who would expect that when you have that kind of vehicle, that it's going to transport you
right
to the next level.
Right. As did I.
Yeah, okay.
But
okay, that's what I want to get at.
That is
okay.
A great deception.
That's what I want to get at. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's a great deception. The Bubba Gump Shrimp Company, mm-hmm. That whole thing, I've actually never eaten at one of those restaurants. To me, it's a very deep area of pain in my
mm-hmm.
life
mm-hmm.
because I thought that I would be taken care of for working so hard and elevating this material to such a place. I was the lowest paid, and all the money I made on that movie, I had to actually reinvest in a publicist so that people would know what I really looked like, because it actually injured my career, Forrest Gump. I couldn't work for a long time after that movie because people thought that was just a guy with that lip, and all my character work went by the wayside, and I had to pay a publicist to put me in magazines so people could see what I really looked like. And, you know.
And such a handsome fellow.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate
yeah.
that. But you know, it's a great deception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel the pain, and I hear it. What was the take, other than the fact that you had to hire a publicist, that was the way you dealt with it. What
right.
was the takeaway?
Well, the takeaway is no matter what happens,
yeah.
you still do your very best work.
Right.
I mean, I just coined that. That's from Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You do the absolute best work that you possibly can and represent yourself at the highest level. I kept trying to figure out a way to make that work for me.
Yeah.
But that chapter never really worked for me.
Yeah.
So this is my, I've been an actor, a professional actor since I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 59 this year.
Yeah.
This is my 50th year in the game. And I love it. I love
yeah.
what I do. But I also realize that there's more because I want to take my platform and help people with it.
Yeah.
And I know what this business is. You know what I mean? It's a
yeah.
grinder. It's a meat grinder.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll chew on you a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's greater works that I want to do. There was a gentleman who was considering jumping off a freeway not long ago. And the LA Times wrote about it. I was actually running late to an appointment because I wanted to help him. And I just want to do good work, man. I want to help people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
all. I just want to help somebody.
I can't say it enough. I'll close where I began. I've seen a lot of great performances this year, but I personally have not seen anybody as brilliant as Michael T. Williamson, as Gabriel in Fences alongside Denzel Washington and Golden Globe winning Viola Davis.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.